Chapter 14. I can't hold my breath any longer, thought Ransom. I can't. I can't. Cold, slimy things slid upwards over his agonized body. He decided to stop holding his breath, to open his mouth and die. But his will did not obey this decision. Not only his chest, but his temples felt as if they were going to burst. It was idle to struggle. His arms met no adversary, and his legs were pinioned. He became aware that they were moving upwards, but this gave him no hope. The surface was too far away. He could not hold out till they reached it. In the immediate presence of death, all ideas of the afterlife were withdrawn from his mind. The mere abstract proposition, "This is a man dying," floated before him in an unemotional way. Suddenly a roar of sound rushed back upon his ears, intolerable boomings and clangings. His mouth opened automatically. He was breathing again. In a pitch darkness full of echoes, he was clutching what seemed to be gravel and kicking wildly to throw off the grip that still held his legs. Then he was free and fighting once more, a blind struggle half in and half out of the water on what seemed to be a pebbly beach, with sharper rocks here and there that cut his feet and elbows. The blackness was filled with gasping curses, now in his own voice, now in Weston's, with yelps of pain, thudding concussions, and the noise of laboured breath. In the end he was astride of the enemy. He pressed its sides between his knees till its ribs cracked, and clasped his hands round its throat. Somehow he was able to resist its fierce tearing at his arms, to keep on pressing. Once before he had had to press like this, but that had been on an artery, to save life, not to kill. It seemed to last for ages. Long after the creature's struggles had ceased, he did not dare to relax his grip. Even when he was quite sure that it breathed no longer, he retained his seat on its chest, and kept his tired hands, though now loosely, on its throat. He was nearly fainting himself, but he counted 1,000 before he would shift his posture. Even then he continued to sit on its body. He did not know whether in the last few hours the spirit which had spoken to him was really Weston's, or whether he had been the victim of a ruse. Indeed, it made little difference. There was, no doubt, a confusion of persons in damnation. What pantheists falsely hoped of heaven, bad men really received in hell. They were melted down into their master, as a lead soldier slips down and loses his shape in the ladle held over the gas ring. The question whether Satan, or one whom Satan has digested, is acting on any given occasion, has in the long run no clear significance. In the meantime, the great thing was not to be tricked again. There was nothing to be done then, except to wait for the morning. From the roar of echoes all about him, he concluded that they were in a very narrow bay between cliffs. How they had ever made it was a mystery. The morning must be many hours distant. This was a considerable nuisance. He determined not to leave the body till he had examined it by daylight, and perhaps taken further steps to make sure that it could not be reanimated. Till then he must pass the time as best he could. The pebbly beach was not very comfortable, and when he tried to lean back he found a jagged wall. Fortunately he was so tired that for a time the mere fact of sitting still contented him. But this phase passed. He tried to make the best of it. He determined to give up guessing how the time was going. The only safe answer, he told himself, is to think of the earliest hour you can suppose possible, and then assume the real time is 2 hours earlier than that. He beguiled himself by recapitulating the whole story of his adventure in Perelandra. He recited all that he could remember of the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, the Chanson de Roland, Paradise Lost, the Kalevala, the Hunting of the Snark, and a rhyme about Germanic sound laws which he had composed as a freshman. He tried to spend as long as he could hunting for the lines he could not remember. He set himself a chess problem. He tried to rough out a chapter for a book he was writing, but it was all rather a failure. These things went on, alternating with periods of dogged inactivity, until it seemed to him that he could hardly remember a time before that night. He could scarcely believe that even to a bored and wakeful man 12 hours could appear so long. And the noise, the gritty, slippery discomfort. It was very odd, now he came to think of it, that this country should have none of those sweet night breezes which he had met everywhere else in Perelandra. It was odd, too, but this thought came to him what seemed hours later, that he had not even the phosphorescent wave crests to feed his eyes on. Very slowly, a possible explanation of both facts dawned on him, and it would also explain why the darkness lasted so long. The idea was too terrible for any indulgence of fear. Controlling himself, he rose stiffly to his feet and began picking his steps along the beach. His progress was very slow, but presently his outstretched arms touched perpendicular rock. He stood on tiptoe and stretched his hands up as far as he could. They found nothing but rock. "Don't get the wind up," he said to himself. He started groping his way back. He came to the unmanned body, passed it, and went beyond it round the opposite beach. It curved rapidly, and here, before he had gone 20 paces, his hands, which he was holding above his head, met not a wall, but a roof of rock. A few paces farther, and it was lower. Then he had to stoop. A little later, and he had to go on his hands and knees. It was obvious that the roof came down and finally met the beach. Sick with despair, he felt his way back to the body and sat down. The truth was now beyond doubt. There was no good waiting for the morning. There would be no morning here till the end of the world, and perhaps he had already waited a night and a day. The clanging echoes, the dead air, the very smell of the place all confirmed this. He and his enemy, when they sank, had clearly, by some hundredth chance, been carried through a hole in the cliffs well below water level and come up on the beach of a cavern. Was it possible to reverse the process? He went down to the water's edge, or rather, as he groped his way down to where the shingle was wet, the water came up to meet him. It thundered over his head and far up behind him, and then receded with a tug which he only resisted by spread-eagling himself on the beach and gripping the stones. It would be useless to plunge into that. He would merely have his ribs broken against the opposite wall of the cave. If one had light and a high place to dive from, it was just conceivable one might get down to the bottom and strike the exit, but very doubtful. And anyway, one had no light. Although the air was not very good, he supposed that his prison must be supplied with air from somewhere, but whether from any aperture that he could possibly reach was another matter. He turned at once and began exploring the rock behind the beach. At first it seemed hopeless, but the conviction that caves may lead you anywhere dies hard, and after some time his groping hands found a shelf about 3 feet high. He stepped up on it. He had expected it to be only a few inches deep, but his hands could find no wall before him. Very cautiously he took some paces forward. His right foot touched something sharp. He whistled with the pain and went on even more cautiously. Then he found vertical rock, smooth as high as he could reach. He turned to his right and presently lost it. He turned left and began to go forward again and almost at once stubbed his toe. After nursing it for a moment, he went down on hands and knees. He seemed to be among boulders, but the way was practicable. For 10 minutes or so he made fairly good going, pretty steeply upward, sometimes on slippery shingle, sometimes over the tops of the big stones. Then he came to another cliff. There appeared to be a shelf on this about 4 feet up, but this time a really shallow one. He got onto it somehow and glued himself to the face, feeling out to left and right for further grips. When he found one and realized that he was now about to attempt some real climbing, he hesitated. He remembered that what was above him might be a cliff which even in daylight and properly clothed he would never dare to attempt. But hope whispered that it might equally well be only 7 feet high, and that a few minutes of coolness might bring him into those gently winding passages up into the heart of a mountain which had, by now, won such a firm place in his imagination. He decided to go on. What worried him was not, in fact, the fear of falling, but the fear of cutting himself off from the water. Starvation he thought he could face, not thirst. But he went on. For some minutes he did things which he had never done on earth. Doubtless he was in one way helped by the darkness. He had no real sensation of height and no giddiness. On the other hand, to work by touch alone made crazy climbing. Doubtless if anyone had seen him, he would have appeared at one moment to take mad risks and at another to indulge in excessive caution. He tried to keep out of his mind the possibility that he might be climbing merely towards a roof. After about a quarter of an hour, he found himself on a wide horizontal surface, either a much deeper shelf or the top of the precipice. He rested here for a while and licked his cuts. Then he got up and felt his way forwards, expecting every moment to meet another rock wall. When, after about 30 paces, he had not done so, he tried shouting, and judged from the sound that he was in a fairly open place. Then he continued. The floor was of small pebble and ascended fairly steeply. There were some larger stones, but he had learned to curl up his toes as his foot felt for the next pace, and he seldom stubbed them now. One minor trouble was that even in this perfect blackness he could not help straining his eyes to see. It gave him a headache and created phantom lights and colours. This slow uphill trek through darkness lasted so long that he began to fear he was going round in a circle, or that he had blundered into some gallery which ran on for ever beneath the surface of the planet. The steady ascent in some degree reassured him. The starvation for light became very painful. He found himself thinking about light as a hungry man thinks about food, picturing April hillsides with milky clouds racing over them in blue skies, or quiet circles of lamplight on tables pleasantly littered with books and pipes. By a curious confusion of mind, he found it impossible not to imagine that the slope he walked on was not merely dark, but black in its own right, as if with soot. He felt that his feet and hands must be blackened by touching it. Whenever he pictured himself arriving at any light, he also pictured that light revealing a world of soot all around him. He struck his head sharply against something and sat down half stunned. When he had collected himself, he found by groping that the shingle slope had run up into a roof of smooth rock. His heart was very low as he sat there digesting this discovery. The sound of the waves came up faint and melancholy from below and told him that he was now at a great height. At last, though with very little hope, he began walking to his right, keeping contact with the roof by raising his arms. Presently it receded beyond his reach. A long time after that he heard a sound of water. He went on more slowly, in great fear of encountering a waterfall. The shingle began to be wet, and finally he stood in a little pool. Turning to his left, he found, indeed, a waterfall, but it was a tiny stream with no force of water that could endanger him. He knelt in the rippling pool and drank from the fall, and put his aching head and weary shoulders under it. Then, greatly refreshed, he tried to work his way up it. Though the stones were slippery with some kind of moss and many of the pools were deep, it presented no serious difficulties. In about 20 minutes he had reached the top, and, as far as he could judge by shouting and noticing the echoes, he was now in a very large cave indeed. He took the stream for guidance and proceeded to follow it up. In that featureless dark it was some sort of company. Some real hope, distinct from that mere convention of hope which supports men in desperate situations, began to enter his mind. It was shortly after this that he began to be worried by the noises. The last faint booming of the sea in the little hole whence he had started out so many hours ago had now died away, and the predominant sound was the gentle tinkling of the stream. But he now began to think that he heard other noises mixed with it. Sometimes it would be a dull plump, as if something had slipped into one of the pools behind him. Sometimes, more mysteriously, a dry rattling sound, as if metal were being dragged over the stones. At first he put it down to imagination. Then he stopped once or twice to listen, and heard nothing. But each time when he went on it began again. At last, stopping once more, he heard it quite unmistakably. Could it be that the unman had, after all, come to life and was still following him? But that seemed improbable, for its whole plan had been to escape. It was not so easy to dispose of the other possibility, that these caverns might have inhabitants. All this experience, indeed, assured him that if there were such inhabitants, they would probably be harmless. But somehow he could not quite believe that anything which lived in such a place would be agreeable. And a little echo of the unman's, or was it Weston's, talk came back to him. All beautiful on the surface, but down inside, darkness, heat, horror, and stink. Then it occurred to him that if some creature were following him up the stream, it might be well for him to leave its banks and wait till the creature had gone past. But if it were hunting him, it would presumably hunt by scent, and in any case he would not risk losing the stream. In the end he went on. Whether through weakness, for he was now very hungry indeed, or because the noises behind made him involuntarily quicken his pace, he found himself unpleasantly hot, and even the stream did not appear very refreshing when he put his feet in it. He began to think that whether he were pursued or not, he must have a short rest. But just at that moment he saw the light. His eyes had been mocked so often before that he would not at first believe it. He shut them while he counted 100 and looked again. He turned round and sat down for several minutes, praying that it might not be a delusion, and looked again. "Well," said Ransom, "if it is a delusion, it's a pretty stubborn one." A very dim, tiny, quivering luminosity, slightly red in colour, was before him. It was too weak to illuminate anything else, and in that world of blackness he could not tell whether it was 5 feet or 5 miles away. He set out at once with beating heart. Thank heaven, the stream appeared to be leading him towards it. While he thought it was still a long way off, he found himself almost stepping into it. It was a circle of light lying on the surface of the water, which thereabouts formed a deepish, trembling pool. It came from above. Stepping into the pool, he looked up. An irregularly shaped patch of light, now quite distinctly red, was immediately above him. This time it was strong enough to show him the objects immediately around it, and when his eyes had mastered them, he perceived that he was looking up a funnel or fissure. Its lower aperture lay in the roof of his own cavern, which must here be only a few feet above his head. Its upper aperture was obviously in the floor of a separate and higher chamber whence the light came. He could see the uneven side of the funnel, dimly illuminated, and clothed with pads and streamers of a jelly-like and rather unpleasing vegetation. Down this water was trickling, and falling on his head and shoulders in a warm rain. This warmth, together with the red colour of the light, suggested that the upper cave was illuminated by subterranean fire. It will not be clear to the reader, and it was not clear to Ransom, when he thought about it afterwards, why he immediately decided to get into the upper cave if he possibly could. What really moved him, he thinks, was the mere hunger for light. The very first glance at the funnel restored dimensions and perspective to his world, and this in itself was like delivery from prison. It seemed to tell him far more than it actually did of his surroundings. It gave him back that whole frame of spatial directions without which a man seems hardly able to call his body his own. After this, any return to the horrible black vacancy, the world of soot and grime, the world without size or distance in which he had been wandering, was out of the question. Perhaps also he had some idea that whatever was following him would cease to follow if he could get into the lighted cave. But it was not easy to do. He could not reach the opening of the funnel. Even when he jumped, he only just touched the fringe of its vegetation. At last he hit upon an unlikely plan, which was the best he could think of. There was just enough light here for him to see a number of larger stones among the gravel, and he set to work to build up a pile in the center of the pool. He worked rather feverishly, and often had to undo what he had done. And he tried it several times before it was really high enough. When at last it was completed and he stood sweating and shaky on the summit, the real hazard was still to be run. He had to grip the vegetation on each side above his head, trusting to luck that it would hold, and half jump, half pull himself up as quickly as he could, since if it held at all, it would, he felt sure, not hold for long. Somehow or other he managed it. He got himself wedged into the fissure with his back against one side and his feet against the other, like a mountaineer in what is called a chimney. The thick, squashy growth protected his skin, and after a few upward struggles he found the walls of the passage so irregular that it could be climbed in the ordinary way. The heat increased rapidly. "I'm a fool to have come up here," said Ransom, but even as he said so he was at the top. At first he was blinded by the light. When at last he could take in his surroundings, he found himself in a vast hall so filled with firelight that it gave him the impression of being hollowed out of red clay. He was looking along the length of it. The floor sloped down to the left side. On his right it sloped upward to what appeared a cliff edge, beyond which was an abyss of blinding brightness. A broad, shallow river was flowing down the middle of the cavern. The roof was so high as to be invisible, but the walls soared up into the darkness with broad curves like the roots of a beech tree. He staggered to his feet, splashed across the river, which was hot to the touch, and approached the cliff edge. The fire appeared to be thousands of feet below him, and he could not see the other side of the pit in which it swelled and roared and writhed. His eyes could only bear it for a second or so, and when he turned away, the rest of the cavern seemed dark. The heat of his body was painful. He drew away from the cliff edge and sat down with his back to the fire to collect his thoughts. They were collected in an unlooked-for way. suddenly and irresistibly, like an attack by tanks, that whole view of the universe which Weston, if it were Weston, had so lately preached to him, took all but complete possession of his mind. He seemed to see that he had been living all his life in a world of illusion. The ghosts, the damned ghosts, were right. The beauty of Perelandra, the innocence of the lady, the sufferings of saints, and the kindly affections of men were all only an appearance and outward show. What he had called the worlds were but the skins of the worlds. A quarter of a mile beneath the surface, and from thence through thousands of miles of dark and silence and infernal fire, to the very heart of each, reality lived. The meaningless, the unmade, the omnipotent idiocy to which all spirits were irrelevant, and before which all efforts were vain. Whatever was following him would come up that wet, dark hole, would presently be excreted by that hideous duct, and then he would die. He fixed his eyes upon the dark opening from which he had himself just emerged, and then, "I thought as much," said Ransom. Slowly, shakily, with unnatural and inhuman movements, a human form, scarlet in the firelight, crawled out onto the floor of the cave. It was the unman, of course. Dragging its broken leg, and with its lower jaw sagging open like that of a corpse, it raised itself to a standing position. And then, close behind it, something else came up out of the hole. First came what looked like branches of trees, and then seven or eight spots of light, irregularly grouped, like a constellation. Then a tubular mass which reflected the red glow as if it were polished. His heart gave a great leap as the branches suddenly resolved themselves into long, wiry feelers, and the dotted lights became the many eyes of a shell-helmeted head, and the mass that followed it was revealed as a large, roughly cylindrical body. Horrible things followed, angular, many-jointed legs, and presently, when he thought the whole body was in sight, a second body came following it, and after that a third. The thing was in three parts, united only by a kind of wasp's waist structure. Three parts that did not seem to be truly aligned, and made it look as if it had been trodden on. A huge, many-legged, quivering deformity, standing just behind the unman, so that the horrible shadows of both danced in enormous and united menace on the wall of rock behind them. "They want to frighten me," said something in Ransom's brain, and at the same moment he became convinced both that the unman had summoned this great earth-crawler, and also that the evil thoughts which had preceded the appearance of the enemy had been poured into his own mind by the enemy's will. The knowledge that his thoughts could be thus managed from without did not awake terror, but rage. Ransom found that he had risen, that he was approaching the unman, that he was saying things, perhaps foolish things, in English. "Do you think I'm going to stand this?" he yelled. "Get out of my brain! It isn't yours, I tell you. Get out of it!" As he shouted, he had picked up a big jagged stone from beside the stream. "Ransom!" croaked the unman. "Wait! We're both trapped!" But Ransom was already upon it. "In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, here goes. I mean, Amen," said Ransom, and hurled the stone as hard as he could into the unman's face. The unman fell as a pencil falls, the face smashed out of all recognition. Ransom did not give it a glance, but turned to face the other horror. But where had the horror gone? The creature was there, a curiously shaped creature, no doubt, but all the loathing had vanished clean out of his mind, so that neither then nor at any other time could he remember it, nor ever understand again why one should quarrel with an animal for having more legs or eyes than oneself. All that he had felt from childhood about insects and reptiles died that moment, died utterly, as hideous music does when you switch off the wireless. Apparently it had all, even from the beginning, been a dark enchantment of the enemy's. Once, as he had sat writing near an open window in Cambridge, he had looked up and shuddered to see, as he supposed, a many-coloured beetle of unusually hideous shape crawling across his paper. A second glance showed him that it was a dead leaf, moved by the breeze. And instantly the very curves and re-entrance which had made its ugliness turned into its beauties. At this moment he had almost the same sensation. He saw at once that the creature intended him no harm, had indeed no intentions at all. It had been drawn thither by the unman, and now stood still, tentatively moving its antennae. Then, apparently not liking its surroundings, it turned laboriously round and began descending into the hole by which it had come. as he saw the last section of its tripartite body wobble on the edge of the aperture, and then finally tip upward with its torpedo-shaped tail in the air, Ransom almost laughed. "Like an animated corridor train," was his comment. He turned to the young man. It had hardly anything left that you could call a head, but he thought it better to take no risks. He took it by its ankles and lugged it up to the edge of the cliff. Then, after resting a few seconds, he shoved it over. He saw its shape black for a second against the sea of fire, and then that was the end of it. He rolled rather than crawled back to the stream and drank deeply. "This may be the end of me, or it may not," thought Ransom. "There may be a way out of these caves, or there may not. But I won't go another step further today. Not if it was to save my life. Not to save my life. That's flat. Glory be to God, I'm tired." A second later, he was asleep.